Shadowcast, episode 33. This week I'm bringing you two stories. Our first story is Dead Rabbit by Mary Mitchell. Mary Mitchell lives in the high deserts of California. She has placed in several contests on writing.com and has had almost 20 stories published in her first 2 years of submitting. Some can be found on Cherry Bleeds, Morpheus Tales, Flurb, Wicket Jungle, the anthology The Black Hole, and the upcoming Novus Creatura anthology. The reader for this story is none other than Laura Best. She lives with two cats and one spouse, author Robert R. Best. She has done voice work for Robert's fiction, as well as productions for Library of the Living Dead Press. She also takes care of her mom, and writes, and sings the occasional zombie parody song. She lives just down the road in mid-Missouri, and can be heard on Watchers of Anarchy fan podcast, as well as Don't Look in the Podcast movie review show. I hope you enjoy Dead Rabbit by Mary Mitchell.
Martha Knox opened the door to her house by pushing it with her bony hip. Her hands were full. In one, her collection of keys, and the other, a small plastic-wrapped item that appeared to be furry and bloody. She placed it on the counter. Her housemate, Elsa, was on the phone talking while she sipped a cup of coffee. "Hold on for a moment, Laura." She put down her cup and pushed the hold button on the phone. "That better not be what I think it is." "Which is?" Martha replied, as her khaki backpack slid off her small shoulders and onto the kitchen floor. The pack, heavy with her college textbooks, made a thud as it hit the white tile floor. Requiring an M.D. to become a pathologist meant a great deal of studying. "A dead squirrel." "Wrong. It's a Mort Sauvilagus Bachmani." Elsa was aghast with disgust. She poured her coffee down the drain and followed Martha with the cell phone. "I'm going to have to call you back in a little while, sweetheart. I've got to kill Mar and clean another of her messes. Bye." By now, Martha was pouring coffee into a huge cup filled halfway with ice and cream. "A dead rabbit? We have an agreement. You swore that none of your projects would ever come into the kitchen area. Why didn't you go around the back and straight into your room with it?" She held up her cup. "I needed coffee." Elsa reached into a drawer and put on disposable gloves. "You need a huge kick in the ass. That's what you need. Then you need to go to a doctor and get a prescription, whatever the hell is wrong with you." From under the sink, she took out a spray bottle that contained bleach. She started to run hot water into it as well. "Nah, I just needed a quick fight with you before you left for the weekend." She smiled, a wicked twinkle in her eyes. "You're going to make all of us sick with this disgusting hobby of yours. You would think anyone with a Mensa and years of college would know better." Mar picked up the small carcass and said, "The odds of catching something from an animal are not that great. Why would I do it if I felt there was a real chance of becoming ill?" "Because you like to press people's buttons. It's one of your ways of getting attention, and because you need pills. Lots of them in all sorts of colors and shapes." "Now what would Tom Cruise say about that?" Martha was in the hall that led to her part of the house, Elsa scurrying behind her with the spray bottle. "Need I remind you that there hasn't been a reported case of Francisella tularensis or myxomatosis in this area for over 2 years? Need I remind you that when you're dead, it doesn't matter?" Mar mockingly pantomimed, licking the dead rabbit, then slammed her door. "Ew! You don't only need pills, you need a fucking straitjacket and then maybe a nice lobotomy. I'll bring the ice pick." Elsa washed the kitchen surfaces and the floors with the bleach solution. She even washed the walls of the hall and Mar's door. When she was through, Elsa knocked on the door to Martha's room, hoping to be heard over the awful emo music that was blaring from the speakers. Elsa said in a small voice, "I liked you better when we were kids." She pushed the door open cautiously. "Mar? Martha?" Now in the room, she could tell that her housemate of the last 3 years was in the shower. She reached over to turn off the CD and eased the bathroom door open part way. "Dr. Frankenstein, Laura and I are leaving for our trip in a few minutes. I'm sorry about what I said." "This," she said half-heartedly. "I'm leaving the info on the fridge. We should be back Tuesday evening around 8 or so, okay? I'll bring you back a present. Want anything special?" The water turned off, and Elsa handed her the pink towel that was lying on the sink. "Well, Igor, or should I say Igoress, how about a stuffed rabbit?" With a pretend lisp, Elsa said, "Yeth, master." A car horn beeped in three short, happy bursts. "Laura's here. Gotta go." It was on her way out that she saw the table with the plastic over it. Something lumpy was covered on top of it. She was sure it was a freshly desiccated, road-killed rabbit. On the drive to Napa, Elsa vented to Laura. "Well, I think Mars off her stool and on the floor of madness." "Now, Laura, she's not that bad. It's not like she's killing things. They're already dead. She says that there is beauty in every organ, poetry in bones, and wonderment in the sinews. To understand life is to understand what makes it possible." "It's creepy. What if one day she contracts a brain disease and kills you in your sleep?" "That's not going to happen." "How do you know?" "Because that kind of thing only happens in bad movies, and this is real life." "How can I argue with that kind of logic?" "Let's drop it and enjoy the trip." "Fine with me." Laura caressed Elsa's hand. Mar cleared the remains of the rabbit away and briefly rinsed her hands. She made a quick sandwich and plunked down to do some studying. There was no getting around it. Russian literature was boring. She put the thick book down and said to the empty room, "This should have been called War and Snore." Martha felt tired and a little achy. It was only 9 o'clock, but it seemed so much later. She reasoned that if she went to bed a little early, she could wake up even earlier. No good would come from forcing herself to stay awake. Mar knew herself well enough to know nothing would stick. She snuggled underneath the Harlequin quilt. Once asleep, wild, technicolor, fevered dreams consumed her. Mixtures of movies and real life erupted, making it hard for her to tell where one began and the other ended. Mar knew she was at home, but somehow she was also in the Sahara Desert. It was bright, brighter than midday on the summer solstice. She turned on the shower and collapsed to the floor. At first, the water felt hot, but she didn't feel as if she could find the energy to care. Her brown eyes, thick and heavy like lead sheets, closed. Rain. The drought of the desert was over. Baked earth and skin drank the water in. Far away, a ringing echoed. She tried to ignore the sound, but the more she tried, the louder it became. She turned her head. A yellow origami wasp appeared and dipped its stinger into a cup of tea. "She must be a paper wasp." "Martha, get up. We have shopping to do." "I want some tea, too," she said, with her mouth and throat dry as hot sand. The wasp paid no attention, but put three more sugar cubes into its tea. Like most insects, it was partial to sweet things. "Mar, come on!" The words floated in the air like purple smoke. She reached up with one hand and touched the inn, making it dissipate into butterflies. She laughed out. "Ridiculous. What's ridiculous is laying there like roadkill." Now the words altered in color and vibrancy. She followed the trail of cotton candy words out of the shower and into the kitchen. "Elsa, I don't feel right." "That's because you're leftovers." A huge brush cottontail stood, holding a spray bottle in its paws. She stared at the rabbit. "I'm sorry, have we met before?" "I should say so." He turned and faced her. His abdomen was open and hollow. The spinal column could clearly be seen. Glistening crimson and pink tissue clung to ribs. Her brown eyes glazed over as Martha gave a small nodding of her head in agreement. "Oh, are you ready?" Martha scanned the room, looking for a sign of what to do next. From her hall, that ringing buzzing came again. The sound was not distant this time. It was so loud, she wondered how the hollow rabbit could hear her. The thought then occurred to her. Of course he could. Rabbits have great hearing with their long ears. A long piece of paper unraveled, like a New Year's party favor, blowing raspberries at her with its forked tongue. Now Martha was wishing she had taken some NyQuil before she went to bed. It would have saved her from talking to animals. The rabbit was speaking. "Large garbage bags and a small handsaw. Mar, hurry, or the jackets will get in." Something was batting the windows. Their faces appeared as if they were made of white wax. No features could be discerned. The long arms of the straitjacket batted at the glass like strange, demented moths trying to touch the light. She was in a different place now, one filled with dark molasses. What did he say? The wasp hovered behind her still. The stinger flicked at Mar as a bead of fuchsia liquid pooled at its tip. There was something familiar about that wasp, but she couldn't make the connections. A choir of song began. She turned around to see where the music was coming from. A shaft of light shone on the small Makita handsaw. She picked it up and made her way out of the pool of molasses. When she was almost free of the dark stickiness, the wasp woman handed her three wooden dowels. Mar recognized them as the sticks that used to be in her birdcage. She held them up to her chest and considered them carefully. These should do fine. Martha placed the things on her desk, which was pushed up, beside her bed. A long tether pulled her out of the room and back into the kitchen. With clown's feet, she trudged through. You have more things to gather. Do you smell chocolate? The rabbit of Hollow no longer had its speckled gray fur. Now, instead of soft rabbit fur, he was smooth and light brown in color. The undead rabbit sat in a field of Easter grass, his ears gone, nibbled away by the wasp. Poor bunny. She positioned the pots around the bed and covered the duvet with trash bags. As Mar laid down, she said, "Won't this be fun?" The wasp and rabbit readily agreed. Poetry to uncover, beauty to unveil, wonderment to discover, the hollow chocolate rabbit said as he began to melt. It won't hurt, will it? Has it ever hurt before? Martha shook her head. No. Why would it now? Another Martha appeared in the room, dressed in surgical greens. You're right, dead rabbit. The room filled with music. Though she did not recognize the song, she tried to sing along anyway. The wasp woman sprayed Mar's chest with hot bleach. Both Marthas said as one, "Thank you." The Martha in green gave a quick but messy Y-cut on the torso of the naked Martha with a scalpel. "That's better. Be careful. We wouldn't want to make a mess for Elsa to clean up." Martha giggled like an impish child. "No, we wouldn't want that." She pulled the skin away, revealing muscles, bones, and organs. Martha in green picked up the cordless handsaw. At only 4 pounds, it was easy to handle. With her left hand, she felt for the xiphoid process and pressed the blade under it. The 4-inch blade began to whirl. It tore through flesh, but had a more difficult time with the sternum. With a little perseverance and pressure, the handsaw did its job. Tissue, once whole, split and then became a moat filled with blood. Like French doors opening to a Garden of Eden, the ribcage expanded out. They said in a joint pink whisper, "Breathtaking." Wooden dowels kept the bones from closing. Ribbons of large and small intestine were placed in pots. "Oh, dear," the standing Martha said, her surgical greens now black, her figure fading into bloody shadows. "I'd so hope to see our heart before we ran out of blood." "I'm home, Martha," Elsa called as she put her bags down on the kitchen floor. "What the hell happened here?" She looked around the once-neat kitchen. It looked as if elephants had come to tea. Pots and pans were scattered everywhere. The refrigerator door was open, the smell of rotting food thick in the air. Panic filled her mind. Something was wrong. She gave a quick look to see if she saw any blood or a sign of a break-in, and saw none. "Mar, are you all right?" Elsa headed toward Martha's wing of the house, opening the door casually, hoping to find her asleep with her headphones on like she had so many times before. An intense, pungent smell assaulted her nostrils, a distinctive smell, a smell of decaying death. What Elsa saw was an image she could never remove fully from memory and would be recalled in flashes for the rest of her days. Her peaceful dreamscapes would turn too easily into nightmares of Martha's self-desiccated corpse.
Our next story is The Isolated by Rachel Lieberman. Rachel's work has appeared or is forthcoming in Acapella Zoo, Cavalier, Literary Couture, An Enemy, Sidecar, and Awkward. She received her bachelor's in creative writing from Chester College of New England and will be starting her MFA in writing for children and young adults at Vermont College of Fine Arts in January. She's also the editor for Blue Leaf Publications. And here's The Isolated by Rachel Lieberman. The Isolated by Rachel Lieberman. Vampires or zombies? What kind of monsters are we dealing with? That's what the news programs used to ask. They don't anymore. Not since the president's wife sank her teeth into his neck during a press conference. Yasmin wonders if things might be better if they were zombies. It'd be easier to kill them if they just moaned, with no idea who they were before. She sits at the kitchen table, her hand delicately tracing the etchings on the handle of her Glock 17. Next to it are 10 long wooden stakes, each about 3 feet. She takes one with the Glock in her other hand and goes into the living room. Outside, she hears birds chirping eagerly to one another. It helps her pretend the world is calm and safe. It makes her want to go outside. Something lurches in her stomach, in her throat. Everything's dimmer now. She shuts the curtains, so it's even darker. Then she sits on the couch, which is the furthest point from the window. She doesn't want to see outside. She can barely stand the sounds. "Somebody help!" The shout comes from just outside the window. Yasmin jumps up. Her breathing shortens. She grips the stake tighter and winces from the resulting splinter. She can picture the bit of wood under her skin, struggling, trapped there. The woman outside screams again. "Somebody help! Please! My little boy! I don't know where he's gone. I need to find him before..." She can't finish the sentence. Everyone knows the end anyway. Yasmin stands with legs like rubber bands. She stumbles to the window and flicks one plastic shade aside. She recognizes the woman, a neighbor. She does have a little boy, maybe 8. She had a daughter, too, who was about to go off to college, but they caught her. She went outside one night a couple weeks ago. Yasmin knows because the screaming woke her up. The girl might be one of them now, or they might have dragged her off to eat her. Either way, she's gone. During the day, the only job the police have anymore is to find remains, almost always drained of blood, almost always missing limbs. If they can't find your body, they declare you an enemy of the state. Yasmin nods. It's the easiest way to do things. She was going to leave 2 weeks ago, pack everything up and go to her parents' house in the city. She needed her mommy and daddy for the first time in years. Then the city was placed under martial law. "Stay in the suburbs," she was told by the state. By her parents. Over the phone, her father, in tears, urged her not to leave the house. It would only get worse, but there was less food for them there. "Stay inside at night. If you have to go out, do it, but be back by sunset. Call everyone you know. Tell them. Tell everyone you can to stay inside. Maybe you can starve them out." She was sobbing more than him. "Listen to me. Calm down and listen. You can't trust anyone anymore. Don't let anyone in. Don't help anyone after dark. No matter what they tell you, you'll be safe as long as they can't come in. I love you." A day or two later, the neighbor's daughter went missing. Yasmin hasn't been able to get a hold of her parents since. Now the poor woman outside, looking for her other child, desperate not to lose the last of what she has. Yasmin frowns. Should she go out there? She should. The woman is defenseless. At least Yasmin could give her a stake. She isn't safe out there. Any minute out there, they could come out from nowhere and descend on her. If they're hungry enough, they might drink her from right there and leave her corpse sprawled out in the middle of the road. Any minute now. No, it's dark enough already. They could be out there right now. The woman doesn't even need a weapon. It's not right. She keeps staring out the window. The neighbor notices her in her frenzy. "Please! I'm just trying to find my son. Have you seen him?" Yasmin shakes her head. The woman puts her hand over her mouth. I don't know what to do. He's just a baby. I looked all around the house. I thought he would listen when I said not to go outside. She sobs deeply inward. I don't know what to do. Her face is raw and wet. Please help me. Never leave the house. Never, ever leave the house. Yasmin opens the window and tosses out the steak. The trembling woman approaches it, picks it up, and studies it as if she'd never seen anything so strange. I don't know how to use this. I'm not one of them, I swear. Yasmin shuts the window and closes the blinds again. The woman keeps shouting, begging for help. Her screams grow more and more frantic. She keeps her eyes closed tight. Go back in your house. He's gone. Just go back in your house. She's still right outside, studying the bushes in Yasmin's yard as if preparing to explore them. Go away. Get away from me. Yasmin's still gripping the Glock. She wants the woman away from the house. This is hers. She opens the curtains and windows once more and points the gun outside. Get away! Your son's not here! Go away! The woman stares at her, petrified, mouth agape. I'm just looking. I'll only be a minute. I mean it! She fires a warning shot over the woman's shoulder. The next one will be in your heart! I told you I'm not one of them. There are more wrinkles in her face than there were a moment before. Her hair is matted and her entire body trembles. Please, believe me. I don't want to come in. I said go away! Off my property! I'm leaving. The woman backs up, still clutching the steak. Thank fucking God you don't have kids. What the hell have you lost? Far behind her, Yasmin sees moving shadows. She shuts the window and blinds again. Food. She needs food. She goes into the kitchen and grabs some granola out of the tin. A few handfuls usually keep her going for the night. In the distance, there's an ear-piercing scream. She grips the end of the kitchen counter. Then there's screeching of wheels, the pounding of running feet, the creak of an opening front door, and its subsequent slam. The front door opens. Hello? It's Toby. She turns around. He has a belt across his torso, fitted with stakes. He runs over and grabs her. I missed you today, she says, trying to put on a brave face for him. There were some people I wanted to check on today. I'm here for good, I promise. Did you see anything out there? There were a few right outside. They were distracted by some woman, though. His mouth twitches. No one wants to think about these things happening, let alone have to watch it and walk away from it. Oh, God. She buries her face in his chest. I didn't believe her. You can't believe anyone these days. Are you really staying this time? He nods and grips her shoulders. Yeah, I'm staying. Have you been eating? Keeping your strength up? I've got granola. Man, I'd kill for a burger right now. Do you have any jerky? Yeah, plenty. You can have some. It's in the pantry. He goes over to it. You know what I need? I heard people have been growing vegetable gardens, trying to keep a steady food supply so they don't have to leave their houses. They just tend them during the day. He always had a way of keeping her mind off the bad stuff, even before all this. She's not sure what she would do without him, what she would have done if he'd been stuck in his apartment, in the city, like her parents. Maybe we should do that. He has a tepid expression. I also heard that they come at night and destroy them, pull them right out, roots and all. So these families, they have to stand there and watch while their dignity gets ripped from the soil. He balls his right hand into a fist and raises it to his shoulder. A brown stick of dried meat nestles between his grip. He gets an angry bite from it. Yasmin holds her arms to her body. Why would they do that? Because they're animals, he says, his mouth full. Fucking animals. They think it's funny, or they don't have anything better to do. I don't know why they do it, but it's just barbaric. She's getting restless in here. They need a distraction. Do you want to keep playing Monopoly? I've got it all set up. Yeah, give me a minute. I haven't eaten anything all day. Stay away from the windows. Just don't look out there. Thinking it makes it all the more difficult to resist. Just a peek. If there's anything out there, it won't be different from any other night. If there's not anything, she can pretend, just for a second, that things are normal. The woman's gone. Yasmin doesn't strain her neck too much trying to look. Instead, she just looks at Toby's car in the driveway. It's familiar. Constant. I missed you today, she says. I missed you too, he calls from the kitchen. She's holding the Glock. Toby's car windows are painted black. No. No, they aren't. It's a trick of the light. She nearly laughs at herself for thinking it. Her hand flicks the outside light on. It has a mind of its own sometimes. Nothing bounces off the windows. They've been painted black in quick, thick, messy strokes. You were supposed to be able to tell the difference. Sweetie? She screams and turns around, shooting him in the shoulder. It goes through one of his stakes, and bits of wood go flying everywhere. He stumbles back, and for more than a moment, she's sure she has made a mistake. But he doesn't fall. 3 days ago, they slept in till noon. It was the sunniest day they could remember. They repumped air back into the bike tires. It was still quiet during the day, but easier to forget why. They took a picnic to the lake, complete with a checkered blanket. Yasmin always wanted one of those checkered blankets. After eating, they lay next to each other, stretching their feet so that the grass tickled their toes. He brought her face to his, and they kissed for what seemed like hours. At first, they weren't sure if they wanted to make love out there, in case someone walked by. But then they decided they didn't much care. So they did. Tenderly. Slowly. As if it were the last time. He was gentle, but profound in his movements, and she made sure to stroke every inch of him. She liked his skin. She liked her skin against his. His skin. It wasn't so pale before. You missed, he says. Maybe what, 5 inches too high? He makes a clicking sound with his tongue. I meant to tell you to stick to stakes. They're a little easier to aim with. He takes off the belt and throws it behind him, onto the kitchen table with the rest of the stakes. Way back in the beginning, before the electricity kept getting cut sporadically, this preacher came on TV. Yasmin never placed much stock in religion, but she watched him, transfixed by his angry, contorted face. He stood at the podium with an open Bible in front of him and kept poking the pages hard with his finger. God has forsaken us. He has trapped us here to be our own demise. But He has designed our end, not us. We must now watch as demons possess those we've trusted, as our children are devoured by our spouses, as our world leaders can only stand idly by. She thought he would say they should let God have his way. But he lowered his voice and stared at the camera. If we are to survive, we must accept that those who are affected are not simply afflicted with a sickness. They are no longer who they were before. Don't trust them. Don't listen to them. Humans are not the enemy. The devil is. Don't trust anyone. These are crazy times, when she starts believing Bible thumpers. I don't want to hurt you, Toby, she says. He laughs, but it's not the mirthful laugh he always makes when she tells a good joke. She never heard such an awful sound before. Not from him. Not from anyone. It gets into her bones and pulls them out of joint. He's on her in an instant. The back of her head hits the door. She can feel her syrupy blood getting into her hair. Hear the faint squish of it against the wood. She wants to plead for her life, to beg him to leave and never return. But it's not just his teeth that are sharp. Every feature, from his eyes to his hair, has developed points. She brings her knee forward as hard as she can. He stumbles and lets go with a loud moan. At least that area is still tender. You silly bitch! He sounds like an angry dog attempting speech. I was gonna save you. You know that? Make it so that we could really be together. But now you've gone and pissed me off. She doesn't want to piss him off. She doesn't want to please him. That kitchen table is all she has. As she runs to it, she looks at the back door. She let him in. Last night, he knocked on the back door, which she always kept locked. She told him to come in, before asking him why he didn't come through the unlocked front door. He said he was being chased and didn't want to risk it. When she looked out back, she saw them coming. She believed him. She slept in the next day, and he was already gone. He left a note about how he was going to find his car and try to track down some people. He'd be home before sunset. He wasn't home before sunset. Don't trust anyone. But why can't she trust Toby? There sure as hell isn't anyone else around she can trust. She can't be alone in this. She makes it to the table just as he gets to his feet. He's walking towards her slowly, like he's mocking her. She picks up a steak and holds it like she saw Buffy do once. He laughs again. We could do this forever, you know, this back and forth. Or we could leave, and I could introduce you to some of my new friends. They're not as bad as you think. Out of my house. Her voice shakes so much she's afraid her words are indecipherable. It doesn't work that way, sweetheart. Her wrist shakes. She could put it down. Let him have her. He'd kill her. Or he'd make her like him. Either way, she wouldn't be stuck. She wouldn't be afraid. It'd be nice to be afraid of nothing. Just put it down. We'll pretend this whole thing never happened. It's like there's glue on the wood. She can't let go. Do it. Now. His eyes are different. She can only see black. He looks like all the others, a pale and poor imitation of the man he used to be. Pretending to be Toby must be exhausting, especially if you're pure evil. Don't let anyone in. Don't trust anyone. They're not your loved ones. There's a terrifying small growl from the back of his throat. 2 months ago, she changed the channel when she saw preachers. She helped her neighbors when they couldn't find their kids. 2 months ago, her neighbors weren't losing kids. Fuck this. His teeth are sharp. If she had more time to think, she would remember going to the zoo when she was 5 and being frightened by a yawning lion. For weeks, whenever she closed her eyes, she would see it unhinging its massive jaws and baring teeth so sharp it could bite clean through her arm. Toby bites her arm. She cries out and with her free hand stabs him in the shoulder and pulls the stake out again. It falls to the ground with a dull clank. Blood gushes out of him, and from the corner of her eye she sees him grin. He thrusts it to her face so fast that she doesn't have a chance to move out of the way before he forces the gaping wound into her mouth. She shoves him and spits, but a few lone drops slide gleefully down her throat. They taste sour, like they've rotted. It's too late, you know, he says. That's all it takes, just a little bit. Tiny dark spots appear in her vision. She struggles to stand. He's laughing. It's the laugh more than anything else that makes her sick to her stomach. She leans on the table. He holds her, still laughing. And what she hates is that she can't push him away. She wishes he would just kill her, just sink his teeth into her jugular and be done with it. But he's almost gentle, almost tender. After a few moments of breathing, her voice finally crawls up through her windpipe. Let go. He doesn't respond, but smooths her hair behind her ear. She wants to vomit, but all she can do is shake. The steak on the ground is covered with his blood, slowly darkening as it dries. She wants it. When she thinks about it hard enough, she can feel her hands wrapping around it. She knows she can't get out of his grip by struggling against him. But the steak is on the floor. She needs to be on the floor. Her knees feel stronger, but she pretends they've given out again and makes it to the ground. When her hand hits the floor, she feels relief for the first time in what seems like an eternity. Just give it a few minutes. It'll all be over then. You can already start to feel it happening, can't you? She keeps her head low and lets her eyes wander towards it. He doesn't notice. If it's already happening, if she's already turning into him, then she should be like him, fast. It's within arm's length. If she stretches, one movement. She gives herself that one movement, and throws her arm out. And it works. The stake is in her hand. He tries to grab her, but she rolls herself into a ball, so that his grip only brushes her ass. Nice try. Very nice, in fact. She knows he's about to pounce on her. It's the only logical step. She rolls over, the tip of the stake pointed up, the butt against her chest. She won't miss this time. She doesn't. Then, the monster strips away. That demonic thing that has Toby's face dissolves in a burst of rage and absolute fury. She never imagined he could look so angry. Then, she sees Toby. Toby from a few days ago, when it was still him. Apologetic, pleading for her forgiveness, maybe even for his life. She tries to speak, but there's no time. He freezes up. His skin turns from a pale white to a murky gray. The blood around his wound turns to ash, and he falls on top of her. Completely. Dead weight. She's never thrown anything off her so quickly. But she can still feel his lifeless hand against her thigh. She remembers holding it. There's a scream in the far distance. She sees a bit of blood on the ground and wonders if it's hers or his. Oh God, she can already smell it. Don't trust anyone. The only one you can trust is yourself. She can't be like him. The steak is still good, still sharp. She holds it again, but this time, it doesn't give her the comfort it did before. She's frightened of it, almost as frightened as she was of him. She wasn't lonely before, because she still had Toby. Now, not even the neighbor down the street will help her. It really is still sharp. She holds it up, pointed directly at her heart. Part of her wishes that when she pierced Toby, the other end would force its way into her as well. But that didn't happen. No use dwelling on the past. One more thrust. Just one more. It's not like there's anything left. But there is a bit left. On the floor, slowly drying. It'll go to waste. She can't figure out if she's actually turning or if it's all in her head. It's probably all in her head. One thrust. Easier this time. No one to stop her. She's the only one left. Her arm, with a mind of its own now, puts it back on the floor, presses it all the way to the fridge. The rest of her convulses with shame. As the tears come, she throws herself onto the ground and begins lapping the blood eagerly off the tile. Both of these stories had moments I'll not soon forget. You've probably learned by now, if you've listened for any length of time at all, that I have a tendency to immerse myself fully in whatever I'm working on, whether it be the podcast, my writing, or something else. I tend to not go at anything half-ass. It's not really the old, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. Although that certainly has a part in it. It's more that if it's not worth doing all out, then I don't waste my time at all. You know, I never really compared that to self-dissection, but it does have its similarities. I guess she doesn't do anything half-assed either. Well, she might. Now. The second story, The Isolated, hit home with me because I love seeing new twists and turns on old wore-out tropes. Vampires have been done a lot. And the reason I like this one is because we rarely get to see inside the head of a vampire. Sure, it's been done. But in this case, we get to see the internal struggle with her changing body chemistry, her changing mental outlook, her changing needs and desires. I think Rachel pulled it off really well. A lot of you have seen something similar over at my site at jasonwarden.com, where I have a zombie series up. Again, zombies are much the same as vampires. For the most part, they're wore out. But all of mine are from the zombie point of view. Stop in sometime if you haven't already. I think you'll like what you see. And who knows, if I get a few requests, I might just podcast something later on. For now, I think I'm going to call it a night. I have a long day of waiting tomorrow, as the winner of the Parsec Award for Best New Speculative Fiction Podcast is announced at 3 p.m. Central. I'm hoping we can pull it off for Tia. But no matter what, this last year has been a great one, and I couldn't have done it without all of you. So thank you all for listening. I'll have a surprise coming for you in a couple weeks. And then on October 1st, we'll be podcasting the Masters of Horror anthology on a weekly basis. That's right, for 16 weeks straight, you'll get a great horror story in your ear hole every week, read by some of the best voices I could find. I hope you'll be listening. Finally, as always, I ask you, I plead with you, if you like these stories, please tell a friend, tweet it, blog it, or add it to your Facebook status. Share it any way you can. Of course, you could just save time and trouble and just click the donate button as well. Unfortunately, none of this is free, and we rely on you to keep going. I wish you all a great holiday weekend. This episode was produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Our music was by Christopher Carlson. Until next time, stay well.